Case number 12-7074 et al., Christina Conyers Williams versus Robert Johnson, individually and as Senior Deputy Director, Addiction Prevention et al., appellants. Ms. Johnson for the appellants, Mr. Zavaniak for the intervener, and Mr. Carl for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Christina Williams told the D.C. Council that an agency-wide data management computer program was not quite complete, but that it would be fully and successfully installed within 9 months. She now claims that she is a whistleblower because she thought the program would never work. But she did not say this to the council, and the powerful protections of the Whistleblower Protection Act are available only to employees who actually disclose serious misconduct, not those who withhold that information from the people who need it most. Ms. Williams only provided two pieces of information in her counsel testimony. Although she was at the witness table for 10 minutes, it was Councilmember Catania that did most of the talking. She said, first of all, that the program, which is called ACES, at that point could only capture demographic data of the clients at the primary intake center. But when she said this, and this is very important, she emphasized that this was only temporary, because the second piece of information she provided the council was that the program would be successfully installed and would capture all of the national outcome measures that it was supposed to accomplish within just 9 months. And she has offered no evidence to at trial or during her counsel testimony suggesting that this 9 month time frame represented the sort of serious, blatant, and non-debatable error that rises to the level of the type of misconduct that the disclosure of which provides protection under the Whistleblower Act.
That went to the jury, didn't it?
I'm sorry?
Did that go to the jury?
It did indeed, yes. And the district.
So you're saying the jury based its decision on no evidence on that question?
That's correct. I mean, the district this should not have gone to the jury. The district should have succeeded at summary judgment, and if not then, should have been granted judgment as a matter of law after the plaintiff's case in chief. So the verdict is fairly irrelevant to this court's analysis.
And you couldn't read that. I'm looking at the testimony. The jury couldn't hear about that testimony and decide that what she had revealed was that this program was nothing like what the councilman and other members of the council thought they would be getting. Simple demographic. Well, it certainly was appalling to me when I read it, and I'm thinking if I'm on the jury, she's exposed it. She's saying this is nonsense, and these people obviously. Now, she's trying to protect her back when they're saying, well, can you get it done? Because she said, I'm in a position of authority. We think we can get it done, but we're not there, and we're way beyond, and we're spending a lot of money to do it.
And I have a couple of responses to that. First of all, she didn't talk about how much money was being spent. She didn't say it was costing too much money. Second of all, she didn't say that the program was behind schedule. In fact, there's no evidence aside from what she told the jury at trial that the program was behind schedule. In fact, what she told the jury at trial was that when she first took over the program, the original end date for completion of the program was November 2006. That's exactly what she told the jury. And if you look at it's in Joint Appendix 404, that was the deadline for closing out the entire program, November 2006. What she told the council is right now it's capturing demographic data. By November 2006, it's going to be doing everything you want it to do. And so there's no context suggesting that it was supposed to be capturing more than demographic data at this point.
I wish you were looking at something very different. And what she told the council and what Catania was saying, Michael, he was apoplectic. At least it appears that way on the page.
I want to urge the court not, I mean, the written page is very useful, but the evidence at trial, the actual evidence.
Wait, what are we looking at?
You're looking at the videotape. There's a videotape of the testimony. It's in the joint appendix. The transcript was provided to the jury for the jury's convenience, and it is, of course, provided to this court for this court's convenience, and it is helpful. But this court should look at the videotape itself, because Councilmember Catania clearly wanted the program to be further along, but Ms. Williams has not indicated that she has not provided any evidence from which an objective, disinterested observer, not Councilmember Catania, who's been involved in this and is very interested, but from which an objective, disinterested observer would believe that something that she said indicated there was a problem.
Well, all I can tell you as someone who I thought I was disinterested and objective, it certainly looked like it was a telling, the information was telling in terms of damning the program. And she's sitting next to her boss, right?
Yes, she's sitting right next to her boss.
And her, I'm guessing, her apparent fears about him were well-founded.
Well, that...
Because he went after her. And she knew she had to be careful. She tried to say at one point, I'm in charge, take responsibility. And he said no. He was essentially saying no or something like that to indicate, I'm here.
During the counsel testimony, no. Please watch the video, because there's nothing in the counsel testimony indicating that she is not in charge of the program. There's nothing in the counsel testimony suggesting that she is telling the counsel there's a problem here. What she was telling the counsel, every time she opens her mouth to the counsel, what she is urging the counsel to believe is that there is no problem here. She is assuring the counsel. She says, no, we haven't quite taken this on the road, but we are getting there. When she talks about...
Well, there's a current problem, but it will be corrected at some point in the future. But as of where it was at that moment, it wasn't where it had been expected or hoped to be, right? And she was...
According to her trial testimony, but this is not what she told the counsel. There's nothing in her submission to the counsel that suggests this is the program is not where it's supposed to be. There's nothing about that. Now, Councilmember Catania wanted it to be farther along. He apparently, from the testimony you can tell, had been involved in the program long before Ms. Williams ever came to the job.
She was disclosing the status of where they were in terms of collecting data, and that was not a fact that Catania was satisfied with, right? And so it was disclosing a negative fact, so to speak.
Yes. I think that Councilmember Catania would have been happier if there was further progress being made. But you have to consider the complete lack of context of the evidence here.
Why was Johnson so angry then?
The problem...
If there was nothing negative said, his reaction makes no sense.
Well, and this...
He got on her immediately. He changed the submission that was going to go to the council. He obviously didn't like what she said, and he obviously got it, that what she said was damning, and then he went after her after it was over.
Well, the part
That's
where,
the context.
The part where he went after her after it was over is not something that... It's not something relevant to the question of whether she made a protected disclosure. First of all, it's hotly disputed that he even did this.
It shows, as a matter of common sense, how to read what she said.
Right.
But Mr. Johnson also is not the disinterested objective observer, and we don't know what was going on in his head. He can't testify, well, I did this because I was thinking X, because he denied ever doing these things.
No, but I mean, what we're talking about, though, is whether the judge was right in denying the motion as a matter of law and letting the jury decide it.
Yes, I mean, that's the question is whether, and so...
And is there enough here for a jury to decide? And it certainly looks like there's enough for a jury to say, yeah, she did provide the damning evidence that meets the statutory test.
Well, what I would urge this court to look at is to look at the information provided by her to the counsel.
Right.
Right?
Looking at it.
Just what she said to the council, and all she said to the council is that this program, she provided no context, she didn't say where it was supposed to be, she said the program will be successful, there is nothing to worry about here. That's essentially what she said. And there's nothing in her testimony that suggests any mismanagement for the fact that it was only collecting demographic information at that point. And the test for gross mismanagement is a serious, blatant, non-debatable error, that there is a problem that threatens the very efficiency of the agency, the very mission of the agency. And all she told the council is, this program is going to work. You don't need to worry about it.
Do you think if you say, you testify that something is behind schedule, that qualifies as a protected disclosure?
I think that it would qualify as a protected disclosure only if there was context to suggest that that behind schedule is not the typical type of behind schedule for working with a program that has never been created before, and that it's going to, that the end date is going to end up being behind schedule. And so I think it depends on the context, and Ms. Williams has offered no context here.
What do you mean by no context?
As to it being behind schedule. She didn't even tell the council it was behind schedule. All she said is, this is what it is currently collecting. And so, yes, I think that there's a context in which if you're building a huge building and it's 10 years behind schedule and you reveal that, then that would be a protected disclosure. But if all you say is, we haven't, and she didn't say this, but even if all you said was we haven't hit our benchmark that we wanted to reach at this point, but it's still going to be done on time, it's still going to be complete. I mean, if just revealing where you are in a program and the fact that a council member is not happy about it and the fact that your boss is not happy about it makes you a whistleblower, the district would be subject to whistleblower acts based on almost any council testimony from an employee. Running the government is difficult. The government runs into problems. And the DC Council very clearly decided not to make a disclosure of any mismanagement or of any problem a protected disclosure. It made a very high bar for that, that it has to be gross misconduct or gross mismanagement.
Go ahead.
How about revealing that the agency's written submission was inaccurate?
There's actually three problems with that, and I would like to address them, and I'll be brief. The first is that it is not, it was completely speculative as to whether she knew that she was contradicting the agency when she said that the program could capture only demographic information. And that's the only contradiction. The agency submitted five answers, and they're fairly complex. I think they make up five pages, single-spaced. Five answers to questions that she was involved in. And she testified at trial that there were changes made to all five of them. But she said she went and she sat down at the witness table and she glanced down at the written submission that her supervisors had submitted and she saw that her answer had been changed. That's what she says at trial, my answer had been changed. She doesn't say which one. The first one, the first answer that had been changed had nothing to do with ACES. Maybe that was what she saw. So just to start with, we don't even know whether she knew she was disclosing anything. But secondly, she never testified that she subjectively or reasonably believed that changing an answer and overstating the progress of the implementation of the program was gross mismanagement or a gross, I guess it would be an abuse of funds. Certainly it's not a violation of law because the written answers were not sworn. The only thing she said at trial.
Are you saying before the council she has to use those words, otherwise she's not in the statute?
Not at all. It's certainly not that strict. But I think she does have to bring to the council's attention that she's disclosing something. And we also don't know what she thought about it. She doesn't.
She testified that she was aware and knew that she was contradicting what was submitted.
She did not testify to that. What she testified to, and I think this is an important thing to look at in the record, what she said was that she looked down and she saw that the answers that APRA has supplied weren't true at all. She never testified at trial that what she said to the council contradicted what APRA had provided. And we have her council testimony. We know what she said to the council. There's only one contradiction. She didn't say at trial even that she thought it was a big deal. All she said was that this quote wasn't true at all. So the fact, again, we've never.
Said that where?
At trial. At trial, she said that she looked down, she saw the changed answer, and it wasn't true at all. We don't know which one she's talking about. We don't know if she's talking about the demographics versus client assessment data. And that's a really important distinction because, as we learned in the Freeman case, if an employee does not know that they are making a disclosure, they cannot be a whistleblower. They cannot have had an objective belief that they are disclosing serious misconduct. So essentially what we have, and this is the bottom line, this ACES program was a huge undertaking, okay? And that is clear from watching the whole council testimony. It was meant to replace 90 to 100% of APRA's paper files. It was going to track client data across 5 treatment centers and 50 private vendors. And Ms. Williams has offered no argument or evidence that, had it worked, the time or money spent would have demonstrated any misconduct, let alone the type of gross misconduct that rises to the level that warrants whistleblower protection.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is David Svenich, and I represent the intervener, Councilmember Catania, in this matter. There are two events involving Councilmember Catania that are relevant to this case. The first is the February 2006 hearing that has already been discussed with the court. The second is a March 2006 meeting between plaintiff and her husband and Councilmember Catania. And that meeting led to the investigation of the database system that ultimately is before the court. Now, both parties agree that the February meeting and the March 2006 meeting are legislative activities that fall within the legislative sphere and are therefore protected under the district speech or debate clause. Where the parties depart is that plaintiff wants to compel testimony from Councilmember Catania about an unspecified number of conversations with unknown third parties, and as he describes them, social friends, about whether either of these two events happened and what was discussed at these two events. This sort of fishing expedition is prohibited under this court's rule in Rinpeco and would frustrate the purposes of the speech or debate clause. Moreover, plaintiff argues that the council should be required to produce a privilege log, which is unknown in this court's jurisprudence and is incompatible with the speech or debate clause both at the district and federal level. For these reasons, the district court's decision quashing the subpoenas issued to Councilmember Catania should be affirmed, and Councilmember Catania should be permitted to not disclose his conversations with these unknown third parties. Ultimately, plaintiff acknowledges the standard here, that once the legislative activities fall within the legislative sphere, that's the end of the matter. It is an absolute immunity, and he is free from an obligation to appear at trial, to produce documents in discovery, and there's no doubt that certainly the February meeting and the March 2006 meeting are protected legislative activities. But again, as we note in our briefs, and as plaintiff fails to dispute, the conversations that Councilmember Catania may or may not have had with, again, unknown third parties would constitute an open-ended fishing expedition, and this court's jurisprudence has squarely rejected that. Similarly, the Helstovsky decision rejects the notion that there was a waiver here. Councilmember Catania made no clear or unequivocal waiver that's required under the Supreme Court standard. And the fact that he may or may not have had conversations with strangers to this litigation is irrelevant. And finally, the privilege log, to the extent that there is a requirement for FOIA purposes for a Vaughn Index or a privilege log, this, again, evidences plaintiff's misunderstanding about the effect of the speech or debate clause. The whole purpose is to prevent legislators from being subject to the burdens of production in civil litigation. And because it would be in consonant with the speech or debate clause jurisprudence for a council member to have to produce a privilege log about what he is claiming as a legislative act before he'd be entitled to that act, it would actually undermine the very purposes of the speech or debate clause. Your Honors, I'm at a bit of a disadvantage because although we won below, I'm arguing first, so this is an unusual request, but if I could reserve the remainder of my time to respond to whatever arguments are raised by plaintiff, I would appreciate it.
If it's needed, yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. What we have here is an appeal of a Rule 50 motion, as Judge Edwards wrote more than two decades ago. Such motions are highly disfavored because of the requirements of the Seventh Amendment. And to start off, I'd like to begin with the jury instructions that were given to the jury. And the jury was told that there are four kinds of protected disclosures: gross mismanagement, gross waste of public funds, abuse of authority regarding a contract, or violation of a contract. So we're dealing with a broader universe of protected disclosures. The jury saw the video, saw the DVD, and they were convinced that, in fact, Ms. Williams made a protected disclosure, and that's what the jury verdict says. Mr. Johnson apparently thought that Ms. Williams made a protected disclosure because he said at the next staff meeting, "You made us all look like crooks," and Councilmember Catania thought that she'd made a protected disclosure because he started talking about, "I'm going to introduce you to the False Claims Act," at this oversight hearing where Ms. Williams testified. And if you look at the whole video, Mr. Johnson starts off saying, "This is a really good system." The jury found that was untrue. It was ineffective. It was way behind schedule. The representations in the briefing book were false, and the district was wasting millions of dollars. Magic words are not required to show subjective or objective belief. The district court ruled that there was sufficient evidence to satisfy the burden placed on Ms. Williams as part of a properly instructed jury. There are no objections to the jury instructions that were made below. The district court ruled that there was sufficient evidence to allow the jury to assess the reasonableness of Ms. Williams' views. Again, no magic words are required. The evidence was there. There were the changes in the briefing book. There were there's testimony about it. You know, it really was not a good system. It was ineffective. It was money down the rat hole. And
I may have missed if you covered this, but pardon me, did the jury specify which of the four types of disclosure?
No, they did not, Your Honor. I didn't request that special interrogatory, and nor did the district. And so what we have is a Rule 50 motion that's highly disfavored under the jurisprudence of the court, and the jury in this case found that, in fact, there was a protected disclosure. There was sufficient evidence. We set forth in our briefs our view of the evidence and the closing arguments. The jury had an opportunity to decide. They could have, for example, decided or agreed with the district's characterization of the evidence. The point is they did not.
Give us your argument on the, so I make sure I understand the, does the exemption from 12309 apply with respect to the constructive discharge?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm getting to that next. This has been the subject of a number of opinions, both by the district court and by several judges of the D.C. Superior Court. What the trial judge did in this case is she applied the law in effect at the time her decision was rendered. Every court that has considered the issue has so ruled. There's a notice requirement that regulates secondary conduct. There's no reliance interest on the question of procedure. And what the change in the statute in the what they call the 2009 amendment that was actually passed and approved in 2010 eliminates a procedural requirement. It eliminates a requirement of notice. There's District of Columbia Court of Appeals case law that says the notice requirement that's procedural. That involves secondary conduct. So it's perhaps like the change in, for example, a federal venue statute, that is a procedural matter rather than substantive. And there's a case called Moore versus the Agency for International Development that addresses whether or not a change in the procedural law, such as a change of venue, is in fact, or it does apply to pending cases. And the fundamental flaw we'd submit in the argument that's been made by the district turns on a question of interpretation of a case called Jayola, which was decided in 2012. And if you look at the statute, the 12309 statute, it limits suits for specific kinds of damages. It limits suits for unliquidated damages rather than liquidated. And so the Jayola case, and this is decided under the Human Rights Act, the D.C. Human Rights Act goes through a statutory interpretation and talks about how you could still sue for liquidated damages even without a notice. And so the flaw in the district's argument we'd submit is that you have a situation where Ms. Williams had a claim for one kind of damages, but not for the other. The statute is amended, and that removes that bar, if you like. But Ms. Payne or Ms. Williams continue to have a cause of action under the D.C. Whistleblower Act, irrespective of whether or not she submitted a 12309 notice prior to the amendment of the law. And therefore, her claims under the Whistleblower Act were not barred. They were not extinguished. They continue to be viable, and therefore the language in the district's brief talking about reviving claims is inapposite in a situation like this. And so when you look at the case law interpreting the elimination of the 12309 requirement in light of Jayola, in light of the decisions out there that have specifically addressed the issue, it's what the district court did is simply apply the Supreme Court's decision in Landgraf and several District of Columbia Court of Appeals decisions, which talk about how a notice requirement is procedural and a removal of a notice requirement does apply to pending cases. And there's a case called Tucci that talks about how the 12309 requirement has nothing to do with sovereign immunity. It's purely a notice provision. And finally, the 12309 notice is an affirmative defense that if it's not properly pleaded, then is considered waived. So the presence or absence of the 12309 requirement is not it's not jurisdictional.
She had both liquidated and unliquidated damages claims? Is that what you you saying that she had both liquidated and unliquidated damages claims?
In this case, yes, Your Honor. The back and front pay were the liquidated damages. And that, I would add, it was resolved by stipulation between the parties after the jury trial. The district judge ruled that that would be decided not by the jury, but by the court. And going back to the initial arguments that we made, and the 12309 issue is fleshed out in the amicus brief from the Metropolitan Washington employment lawyers, but we also argued that the statutory notice that Ms. Williams provided to the district in March of 2007, in any event, satisfied the requirements of the law. Because what she did is she presented the District of Columbia with facts sufficient to put the district on notice that it could commence an investigation. So as an alternative argument, the notice that was provided by Ms. Williams in March of 2007 fully satisfied the requirements of rule of the 12309. Now, with respect to the question of what happens, whose burden is it to ask for a special interrogatory? I filed with the court a notice of a Rule 28J letter drawing to the court's attention a case called Pratt versus Pedlin. We think certainly that this is appears to be the majority rule, that the one District of Columbia case that was cited in fact an issue where there were separate claims, and the case as I read it certainly turns mostly on issues like election and remedies. It appears that there is a split in the circuits. The majority of the circuits appear to go with this, what they call the McCord rule, where they call it the waiver or estoppel rule depending upon the circuit, and the argument is and this is what the D.C. Court of Appeals has done as well. We adopt the rule that the defendant who fails to request a special verdict form in a civil case will be barred on appeal from complaining that the jury may have relied on a factual theory unsupported by the evidence when there was sufficient evidence to support another theory that was properly before the jury. And this is the analysis in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, I think the Federal Circuit and the 5th Circuits as well. There is some case law to the contrary in the First Circuit case that's cited by the district. But I think irrespective of what the court decides on the constructive discharge issue, that nevertheless the failure of the district to ask for more specific findings from the jury bars the district from trying to separate and carve out the constructive discharge claim. And moving back to the constructive discharge claim, this is also, in terms of the district's appeal, this is just another attack on the jury's findings. As the court knows, the standard for proving constructive discharge is a very, very difficult standard. It's a very high standard. And the jury was properly instructed. The jury came back and said, yes, a reasonable person would resign under these circumstances where Ms. Williams' position had been abolished. She had to reapply for her position. The damage to her career continued to go on. even though she had already even though she had already been a victim of all the other kinds of harassment, nobody asked that the constructive discharge aspect be separated or sorted out. I just want to address the question, if I may, briefly of immunity. And if you look at the D.C. statute, and it does, the case law and the D.C. statute often tends to follow the constitutional law. There are legislative activities and there are non-legislative activities. This court has considered the issue in Bank in the relatively recent past. But the question, and we've really narrowed the basis of our appeal on this issue. The question for the we raise in our appeal is whether or not a non-legislative activity, whether you call it gossip, whether you call it cocktail chatter about what happened at the meeting between Ms. Williams, Councilmember Catania, and her husband, whether or not that sort of communication is protected by the idea of legislative privilege. And if you look at the D.C. statute and the definition of legislative activities, that sort of activity would be more like, more akin, for example, to addressing the addressing a letter, advocating a certain cause of action, or in this case, issuing perhaps a press release. That there seems to be an informal communication that was made about Ms. Williams' meeting with Councilmember Catania, and the mere existence of that communication, we'd submit, as falls outside of the scope of the legislative privilege. With respect to the question of what the district court did, what the district court essentially said is, if you gain knowledge, or gain knowledge that Ms. Williams came in to speak with Councilmember Catania, and to say, and she comes in and says, well, I don't think the contract really exists at all, and there was this retaliation against me after I testified before your committee, that in fact we believe word got out, and that this sort of communication, this sort of leak, if you want to call it a leak, is not protected by the D.C. statute on legislative immunity. In terms of the argument this morning, we're kind of in maybe a peculiar posture, because I don't know whether or not the district is going to raise any additional argument about the issues that are in the cross appeal. And I have 20 seconds left. I'd like to save those if I may.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I appreciate you giving me time for rebuttal. It's a complex case.
Yes.
I do want to briefly discuss, again, protective disclosure, but I definitely want to spend some time talking about the 12309 question, because
okay.
that is an in-depth, complex question. The key question that Ms. Williams was talking to the council about was, will ACES work, and when will it be done? I mean, that was what Councilmember Catania wanted to know. And what Ms. Williams said is...
But isn't it also... implicit, at least, in the discussion, where is it now?
Yes, that certainly was something that he wanted to know.
Where is it now was not where they wanted it to be.
Well, all we know, and we know this.
Catania says, you know, that's a big whoop,
right,
that we have the race and gender data and nothing else.
Right, but the absence of evidence that I want to point out, there's no evidence that the ability to capture more than demographic information was a threshold, that Councilmember Catania understood this to be a threshold, that was the make or break technological event that would indicate whether there was going to be success. It was,
well, he did say that was just... that'd be something we could buy off the shelf.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we all understood, but again, all that Ms. Williams said is, this is where the program is now, and I assure you it is going to work. Now, I just want to draw this court's attention briefly to Wilburn, because Wilburn is really the key case here. There, an agency director wrote a letter to the council and said that she was talking about a legal contractor, and she said the quality of his work is below average. He's applying the wrong legal standards, and he's not even investigating the appropriate issues, and that he's just barely met most of his contractual requirements. And what the D.C. Court of Appeals said is, they said the gist of her of her letter was that the situation is tolerable and that this does not indicate gross mismanagement. What the D.C. Court of Appeals has said in Wilburn is you look at the gist of what they actually said, you look at the words they say to the council, and if nothing in those words suggests that they're trying to tell the council there's a problem, that they're trying to tell the council that it rises to this incredible gross level of misconduct, then it's not a protected disclosure. And
you say that misleading the council is gross misconduct?
It depends on the context.
Sometimes it's okay to mislead the council.
I think that, it's not okay to mislead the context. It's a question of whether it amounts to the type of non-debatable, serious error that threatens the very mission of the agency. And again, she didn't tell the council that APRA had submitted a false statement. For all the council knew, APRA's supervisors made a mistake. She didn't say there was any falseness made. She didn't say there was a lie. I would like to address just briefly this 12th.
This was live testimony. It would be quite a high bar to say that she has to say about the man sitting next to her, he's lying to you.
But she doesn't have to say. First of all, she doesn't have to say it during live testimony. If she wants to tell him, she wants to tell the council that there's a lie being made, she has plenty of opportunity to talk to the council in a non-public situation, and indeed she did.
She gave live testimony that contradicted the written submission.
Well, yeah, but I would agree, yes. There was one contradiction amongst a very lengthy written submission. But again, we certainly have never had any law or ruling suggesting that any time an employee says something to the council and the supervisor had said something different, that is a disclosure of gross misconduct. There's nothing in the federal courts that suggests this.
That alone, right, there's more here. Do you agree that it was at least embarrassing what she disclosed?
I don't know. I don't want to put words into Mr. Johnson's mouth. He said he had no problem with what she submitted. That was his testimony. Perhaps...
His conduct suggests otherwise.
Yeah.
Well, again, though, his conduct, I mean, it's disputed, and I recognize that we have to accept the facts in her favor, but you also can't get on Mr. Johnson for not justifying his conduct when he says he didn't engage in that misconduct, in that conduct. And that he denies that.
Take a minute or two.
Thank you. I want to address this retroactivity question because this is a complex question. The most important thing I want to note to this court is that no appellate court has ever ruled on this question. So even though there's district court decisions out there, the D.C. Court of Appeals has never considered it. It is a novel question of how to interpret this statute. The bottom line is that the test for whether to apply a statute retroactively, to apply it to events that have already preceded it, according to the Supreme Court, this court, and the D.C. Court of Appeals, is that if applying the statute here would change the legal consequences of acts completed before the effective date, then you do not apply it that way unless there is a clear indication from the council that you should do so. There's no clear indication from the council here you would do so, and it would definitely change the consequences. Consider what the effect of applying the 12309 exemption here would do. It would change the legal consequences of Ms. Williams' failure to notify the district of the claim. Would change it fundamentally, would give her a claim where before none existed.
What would the district have done, or might the district have done differently if it had received timely notice?
Well, the district may well have reached out to her and found her another position in the agency. I mean, her problem at that point was simply, she was no longer being harassed. Her problem at that point was that the new director had not found a place for her, given that she had dissolved the research center, and there's no evidence that dissolution was retaliatory. And so if indeed she was a good employee that everyone valued now that Johnson and Anthony had left, then the district may have reached out. It may have prevented her from leaving. It may have found her a new position. And even though that's not what this court need look at, and I think the case law is very clear that you don't look at what the district did. You look at the four corners of the letter. But consider this.
Well, what I asked now is what they did, but you know how their conduct might have been.
That's how it might have been. And consider this. Every court that talks about constructive discharge says that it stands in the shoes of termination. It is just like a termination, only the employee is forced to leave due to the conditions. Certainly an employee who was terminated and wanted to claim that as an injury would have to submit a claim letter indicating that was the injury that was caused. And even more so for constructive discharge, at least the district knows when it terminates someone. Ms. Williams left for another job because she was unhappy. How was the district to know that she was going to treat that as a constructive discharge? It wasn't until 3 years later, 2010, that the district learned that she was claiming constructive discharge. The district was unable to procure the testimony of Johnson or Anthony at trial, so definitely the concern about the district's inability to quickly remedy problems and deal promptly with...
What was the problem getting their testimony?
Mr. Anthony, I believe, could not be found, and Mr. Johnson is far out of the jurisdiction. The deposition testimony of Mr. Johnson was introduced, but he was not available for trial. I'll also note that Ms. Williams argues that there's some sort of split of the claims as to whether she had to satisfy 12309 for her unliquidated damages claim versus her liquidated damages claims. This court has conclusively resolved that question in Winder and held that the entire Whistleblower Protection Act claim, both liquidated and unliquidated damages, are required, back when the statute applied, notice under 12309. And that analysis is in my brief. So when it comes to whether 12309 was satisfied, the district had no opportunity to address the question. And again, 3 years later, we're suddenly dealing with a claim that was stale. The district is dealing with a claim for which it was absolutely immune. Now, in Payne, which this court decided recently, another whistleblower case, this court said that a statutory...
But the counsel has now said stale claims are fine, right, by getting rid of the notice requirement? I realize for this case that's the question, but in terms of your quasi-policy argument there...
I'm very glad you raised the question of stale claims, because that is, I think, one of the most important things we can learn from the legislative history. When the counsel got rid of 12309, it added a 3-year cutoff to the discovery rule. It actually contracted the statute of limitations. And it did so, and it says this in the legislative history, this is in the joint appendix, to avoid stale claims, which is a risk that was created by getting rid of 12309. Now, this 3-year cutoff cannot apply retroactively. The D.C. Court of Appeals in Finch said you cannot shorten a statute of limitations retroactively. So if this
applied retroactively, would she be out?
Just her constructive discharge claim, but yes. Yes. So if this part of the amendment, if the 12309 part is applied retroactively, right, but the discovery rule cutoff is not, mm-hmm. then suddenly the district could find itself subject to a claim 10 years down the road when someone discovered they had a claim. And the stale claims is something, I mean, there was a trade-off to this amendment. It is not like it was all in favor of providing even more protections. They recognized the risk of stale claims. And so in Payne, this court said that if an amendment adds or eliminates an element of proof on which liability is based, it is substantive and it should not apply retroactively. In Brown, this court described a 12309 notice as an element in a cause of action. It said it acts to create settled expectations. So if this court even reads those two together, it must view 12309 as substantive rather than procedural. It is the district's substantive right to assert immunity once that condition precedent is not satisfied. And to eliminate that would definitely affect the district's rights.
What do you do with the Tucci case?
The Tucci case actually only helps the district's point. What Tucci says...
It tells us that the source of sovereign immunity isn't in this notice.
No. The sovereign immunity, which is sometimes called municipal immunity, the immunity exists anyway. The immunity is in the common law. What the notice is, it is a condition precedent to the waiver of sovereign immunity. Now, in Tucci...
Okay, but there's a waiver of sovereign immunity.
Yes.
Elsewhere in the code or common law, okay? A notice requirement changes. In Tucci, I guess it's added here, it's removed.
What Tucci says, Tucci says, in Tucci, the plaintiff was trying to say that the district couldn't assert any kind of sovereign immunity because of 12309. The plaintiff in Tucci was trying to say that 12309 is less, it means less, and that the immunity means less than what the council intended it to mean. That it was a bigger waiver than it actually was. That's what Tucci was trying to say. What Tucci does, if you read the case, is it actually emphasizes that 12309 is linked. It's inextricably linked to sovereign immunity. And it has nothing to do, Tucci has nothing to do with this amendment or with the elimination of the 12309 requirement.
No, it's the reasoning that matters.
Yes, yes.
And you argued that if that's all we decide that you have, the 12309 issue, we should remand for a retrial on damages?
That's correct.
And how would that happen?
Because there were, I believe, 9 different claims.
No, I understand that. What are you envisioning would happen?
A new trial in which Ms. Williams presented her all of her other injuries, not including the fact that she has now taken a job, because she testified at length about
how... The assumption being that the district is liable, the question is
yes.
How much money?
Yes. It would be a new trial on damages only.
Okay.
This court has no further questions.
Thank you. Any... Thank you. Further?
I'm going to be very brief, Your Honor. We believe that the analysis in Winder to which Ms. Johnson referred was overruled or limited by the JALA decision. We argue that in the brief. Secondly, with respect to the district's talk about how they would have remedied the situation if there had been another 12309 notice, we'd suggest that, and I want to draw the court's attention to the fact that there are four 12309 notices that were submitted here, and the most recent one at Joint Appendix 357, or the latest one at Joint Appendix 357, put the district on notice of all the facts that caused and led to the constructive discharge of Ms. Williams. That's what the jury found. And finally, with respect to the waiver of sovereign immunity is found in the WPA, and the District of Columbia Council abolished the condition preceding requirement, and a D.C. jury found that Ms. Williams satisfied the requirements of the Whistleblower Act and the special interrogatory that was submitted to the jury and one that was to which the parties did not object. Thank you.
Thank all the counsel for a well-argued case. The case is submitted.